Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Cesar Chavez, co-founder and leader of the United Farm Workers, is one of the most influential figures in U.S. history and the U.S. labor movement. The UFW empowered tens of thousands of farm workers to organize for better pay and working conditions. In her new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, award-winning journalist and author Miriam Powell writes, quote, "Chavez's place in history is secure. The route he traveled from migrant worker to national icon has yet to be explored. The path has become well-worn, so strewn with flowers and encomium that reality lies half-buried beneath the legend," end quote. Miriam Powell spent 9 years researching this book and mining the archives of the UFW, including tapes of board meetings. So what did she learn about who Cesar Chavez really was? How did he transform from a migrant worker born to a Mexican immigrant family to a national icon, and how did he lead the movement for farm workers? Miriam Powell is a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor who spent 25 years at Newsday and the Los Angeles Times. She's author of The Union of Their Dreams, a book that's widely acclaimed as the most nuanced history of Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers. And in her new book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, she chronicles his life and activism. Hi, Miriam. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So in your acknowledgments, you say that you're grateful to all the people who helped you over the last 9 years to understand Cesar Chavez. Why did you decide to dedicate so much of your life to understanding Chavez and this movement?
Well, I've asked myself that question from time to time. It evolved into from one project to another, and the 9 years includes a time that I spent at the Los Angeles Times, where I spent a year working on a project that was primarily about the United Farm Workers Union today and what it had become. But it was through the trying to understand the UFW today and its essentially withdrawal from the fields that I got into the history. So I sort of came to it from the present and then got deeper and deeper into the history. And my first book, as you said, The Union of Their Dreams, is a narrative history that deals primarily with just the period from 1965 through the early 1980s, which was sort of the height of the rise and fall of the UFW. And that book was told from the perspective of 8 principal characters who were sort of representative of the groups of people that came together in this very heady mix that helped the union, propel the union to its success in the late 60s and early 70s and throughout the 70s, really. So Cesar Chavez was a central figure in there, obviously because of his role in founding the union, but he was not the central character in the book. He was on stage, but he was not center stage. And you sort of saw him through the eyes of these other characters, lawyers, ministers, students, and so forth. So I actually thought I was pretty much done writing about the UFW and farm workers in Cesar Chavez when I finished that book. But people began to say to me, you know, there is no biography of Cesar Chavez and you should write one because it's a real hole and a gap in the scholarship and in the absence of a book is a problem and it's a reason why people are forgetting who he was. So that is what kind of led me to do the second book, which is a straightforward biography, you know, birth to death. And so the 9 years kind of represents 3 separate projects, and I just got sucked deeper and deeper into the material.
Yeah, that's an understatement because this is a massive book, including the bibliography and the notes. It's just over 500 pages. So talk a little bit about the extensive research that you did for this book.
Right. Well, I knew from my earlier work that there were these archives that you mentioned before that were incredible, just a sort of a treasure trove of material, because Chavez himself saved all of this material, and he was very aware of his own sort of place in history, and I think talked about wanting that history to be told one day, warts and all, and so he preserved the hundreds of boxes of union documents and also instructed other people who worked for the UFW to save material. And then, as you mentioned, he also, during a period of time from the late 60s until the early 80s, extensively taped meetings, conversations, classes that he taught, I mean, all just a sort of variety of of events and conversations that are just a fascinating window into the history of the Union, but into him, you know, his own mind. And so I knew that there was this extensive collection of material available, and then there's several other important archives. There's also, when we get to talk about other things people don't know about Cesar Chavez, people don't know very much about him at all before he founded the Farm Workers Union. And he worked for 10 years as a community organizer, sort of an apprenticeship, and he kept journals and activity reports from that period of time. There's also a lot of his correspondence that has survived, and a lot of people who were key figures in the movement and in the early days, and his relatives as well, have did extensive oral histories during the late 60s. So I knew that there was just an enormous amount of material available, and some of which I had sort of, you know, dipped into for the other projects. But I wanted to make the book be to be extremely sort of comprehensive and scholarly, and so it has lots and lots of endnotes, although they're back there for people who want to see them, but they don't disturb you. There are no numbers in the text or anything like that. It was a major undertaking.
And where are these archives held, and who owns them?
So the UFW archives are in Detroit at Wayne State University at the Walter Reuther Labor Library, which is the preeminent labor library in the country, and many unions have their archives there. They are, as I said, they're these boxes of record, tons and tons of documents, and then these boxes of reel-to-reel tapes. You know, and your listeners have to be of a certain age to even remember what a reel-to-reel tape recorder looked like. But and so the UFW archives and various related collections and other figures in the UFW also sent their materials to Wayne State. There are a number of major collections at Stanford. Fred Ross, who was a mentor of Cesar Chavez and was an important figure in California history also as a community organizer, his papers, which are very extensive, are in the library at Stanford. There is also a major collection at the Beinecke Library at Yale University. Chavez had an authorized biographer named Jacques Levy, who produced a book in 1974, so fairly early on, and Levy was sort of traveled with Chavez and taped lots and lots of interviews with him and his family and other people in the movement, and had enormous access to negotiations and to all sorts of sort of behind-the-scenes events, because the union knew that it would have the ability to, you know, sort of read the material beforehand and censor anything they didn't like. So he just had hundreds and hundreds of tapes, which he transcribed and ended up selling his collection to Yale University. So that's a tremendous resource, too. I mean, he, for example, went on the trip to Europe with Cesar Chavez when Chavez met the Pope, and interviews him on the plane come flying home sort of to get his recollections of the trip. So there are a lot of just, you know, wonderful moments.
Hmm. What's great about the book is you really do take a frank look at Cesar Chavez and this movement. And that's the one part that almost led every review about your book. Liza Featherstone in the LA Times wrote, "Those intent on hero worship will detest Miriam Powell's honest, exhaustively researched biography of Cesar Chavez, the charismatic leader of the UFW who famously led strikes." I mean, it was just interesting to see that a lot of people said, well, if you loved Cesar Chavez, you might not like this book, or you might be kind of surprised by the new information that comes out. Why do you think it's so difficult to show a leader's flaws and to say that this person wasn't perfect in every way?
Well, I think that there's actually more acceptance of it than many people think, because I think that most people are pretty smart and pretty sort of, you know, satiated human beings, understand that everyone has strengths and weaknesses, and our leaders are no exceptions. And I think that, you know, the reason it's kind of amazing that there hasn't been a biography of Chavez written until now. He died in 1993. He actually died this week, 21 years ago. And there was a tremendous, lots of people knew that he was a very complicated person, like all of us are and like all of our leaders are. But people were afraid to go near that because they felt that there was this fear that they might tarnish the reputation of a man who, as you said, was, you know, is to this day the preeminent Latino leader in this country. So there was this reluctance to write about him by the people who understood that that his story was more complicated. And what's been really gratifying to me, and the reviewers, as you say, have tended to focus on the things that have not been written about at any length before. But what I have found in talking to audiences in the last few weeks since the book came out is that people get it. People understand that heroes are complicated, and they actually appreciate the fact that I have taken the time to do this kind of research and put together a comprehensive biography, because the absence of serious scholarship about him until recently is, I think, the reason that he has fallen from our collective memory. Mm. I mean, your listeners, because they're in the Bay Area, probably, you know, maybe the people in the country who are the most likely to actually remember who Cesar Chavez was. When you get outside of California and the Southwest, there's tremendous just blankness about him. And even, you know, Diego Luna, who just did the Cesar Chavez movie, did a stunt in Austin where he stood on Cesar Chavez Boulevard and stopped people and asked them if they knew who Cesar Chavez was, and almost no one could identify him.
Hmm.
I was in Salinas recently, and a high school English teacher in Salinas, California, you know, got up and said, "My students have no idea who Cesar Chavez was."
You even say that a number of farm workers today have no idea who he was and what he fought for.
Oh, yeah. Farm workers today have no idea who he was. I mean, if you say Cesar Chavez, they think you're talking about the Mexican boxer by the same name.
Huh.
I mean, there's been, you know, tremendous turnover in the fields, as there always is. And he's been gone from the fields for so long now. You have just a whole new generation of farm workers who have no idea who he was.
Well, and so many of them are. I mean, we've done so many shows about this. Just recently, we had on an author who traveled with workers from Mexico to the fields, and mm-hmm. so many of these workers are undocumented.
Right.
So what really surprised you after spending so many years doing this research? What is the one thing that really still stands out for you about what you learned?
You know, I just have sort of, I think, came away with this tremendous respect for his indomitable spirit and his vision, really. So I think you can agree or disagree with decisions that he made later on, and there were consequences to those decisions for the labor union. But he was a remarkably visionary person in many ways, and whether that sort of he was ahead of his times in seeing where things were going, and whether that was in terms of his eating organic food at a time when, you know, the organic movement was certainly decades away from reaching its height, or his speech in 1984, which I opened the book with, you know, in 1984, Ronald Reagan had just been elected by a landslide, and the UFW itself was a sort of shadow of itself that was down to a handful of contracts. They were no longer the force in the fields that they had once been. And it was sort of a bleak time for labor in general. And he gets up at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and says, sort of enumerates all of the problems and the poor conditions that farm workers still labor under, and then says, you know, none of that really matters on some level, because what we have shown could be done, the model of farm workers who were the poorest of the poor being able through collective action to achieve what they did, you know, that is an inspiration that will resonate in the cities around the country. And then, you know, this is exactly 30 years ago, almost a little bit less. He says, within 30 years, the cities of California are going to be run by people who look like me, by farm workers and the children and the grandchildren of farm workers. And that was a remarkably prescient thing to say at that point in time.
Right, because you do point out that with the flaws, and we'll talk about those throughout the show, it is important to point out that he did organize some of the nation's poorest workers and took on some very powerful bosses in the state of California.
Absolutely. I mean, he took on the agribusiness, which controlled at that point in time, you know, not only the fields and jobs in the fields, but the schools, the the courts, the police forces, the city halls, and even the church. I mean, the Catholic Church, which later on in the struggle became a big supporter of farm workers in the early years, was not supportive because the financial pillars of the Catholic Church in the agricultural communities of California were the growers. So you can't, I mean, he wouldn't be worth a 500-page book if it were not for his incredibly heroic accomplishments. And I think, as you said, that there's been a lot of sort of media attention on the quote-unquote flaws, but that's part of his personality. I mean, he was able to achieve what he did because of who he was in all of his character. And there's a quote from him that I use in the book that he at one point says, it's not the nice guy who changes the world, it's the hard-headed guy. And so I think that, you know, this is a portrait of him in all of his complexity. And I'm also gratified by the fact that some of the people who work closely with him and considered him a close friend and admired him and are generally considered huge supporters have been very complimentary about the book. So I think that it conveys him in all of his richness and accomplishments.
You look at his entire life. What really struck you about his childhood when you think about where his drive came from?
Yeah, that's a good question. He starts out in for the first 12 years, grows up on a farm in Arizona outside of Yuma, which was owned by his grandfather. And so he has, and this is during the Depression, and he has, he's not a wealthy life by any means, but he's comfortable and he's in a family and he's in a sort of a community that is a very comfortable place for a kid to be. And I think the experience of losing the farm in 1939 and being thrust into the migrant stream in California, they arrive in California a month after the publication of The Grapes of Wrath. So just which is now 75 years, celebrating its 75th anniversary this year, actually. And so those conditions that are described so evocatively by Steinbeck, that is what he faces. And I think that experience of being, going from having a secure home and community to being a migrant worker, and clearly, was a very, very powerful one and drove a lot of his feelings later on.
I'm speaking with Miriam Powell, Pulitzer Prize-winning editor who spent 25 years at Newsday and the LA Times. She's out with a new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. And she'll be speaking on Saturday, April 26th at 4:30 at the San Francisco Public Library. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. She writes, Chavez described his life's work as a crusade against injustice. He spoke of his anger as a child watching his parents humiliate in the fields, and his rage at the racist treatment of Mexican Americans. He traced his rise as a community organizer and his decision to walk away from a steady job to try to bring dignity to farm workers. So what do you want to know about Cesar Chavez? And if you were part of the UFW or if you still organize farm workers, what are your thoughts on Cesar Chavez's legacy and what farm workers face today? And what can we learn by taking a frank look at someone like Cesar Chavez and one of the most important movements in U.S. history? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And so, Miriam, you talk about the fact that a lot of people don't know that he was a community organizer. When he was 37, mm-hmm. he was with the community service organization in San Jose and then quit that job to move to the San Joaquin Valley. So how did he first get involved in organizing?
Well, by 1952, he had kind of worked his way out of the fields. He had joined the Navy. He had come back. He worked again as a farm worker. And by 1952, he was living in San Jose and working in a lumber yard. And a man named Fred Ross, who had sort of been a key founder of the community service organization in Los Angeles, which is the CSO, was really the first grassroots organization and so the beginning of the Mexican-American civil rights movement to some degree. And Ross came to San Jose to expand the CSO and began to have what he called house meetings, which were little group meetings in people's houses where he talked about what the CSO could do. They did voter registration drives. They ran English classes, citizenship classes. They fought police brutality cases, sort of a grassroots effort to empower Mexican Americans who were so shut out of the political process at that point in time. And at one of the house meetings, he meets Cesar Chavez, and Chavez is then 25 years old. And immediately, Chavez grasps the idea of the power of organization as Ross describes it. And Ross immediately sees that this is someone who is very smart and driven and understands the idea of power and community organizing. And Chavez begins volunteering and he takes charge of the voter registration drive in 1952 in San Jose. And within a year or so is working full time for the CSO. Which he continues to do until 1962. So you can, and he keeps, as I said before, activity reports and journals. The CSO was funded largely by Saul Alinsky in Chicago and the Industrial Areas Foundation, and Alinsky required his organizers to do these activity reports. So some years, 1956, for example, Chavez literally wrote every day, mostly in his own handwriting because he didn't have access to a typewriter, what he did that day. And you can really, by reading these reports over the period of time, trace his evolution and his education as an organizer. I mean, here's someone with an eighth grade education who is, you know, incredibly smart and driven and self-taught and begins to read and begins to write more and learns to organize and stays with them in various places. Ultimately, in his last place he worked with the CSO was in Los Angeles, and then decides to leave in 1962.
Well, let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions, quick questions. First of all, I would like to understand what role his Catholic faith played in his life. That's my first question. And then I understand at one point he purged people affiliated, perhaps wrongly, with the Communist Party. I'd like you to discuss that. Thank you very much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Max.
Sure, those are both excellent questions. His Catholic faith was very important to him personally, but to the organization. And he used Catholicism to tremendous advantage in organizing a predominantly Mexican-American workforce for whom Catholicism was a very important force. And so, for example, in the march there was a famous march in 1966 from Delano to Sacramento, which becomes an important kind of way that the movement gains visibility both to farm workers throughout the valley and to the greater world outside of the San Joaquin Valley. And always in front of the march is the Virgin of Guadalupe, who is the patron saint of Mexicans. And so the force of and again, as I had said before, the Catholic Church was not supporting the farm workers then, but by marching behind the banner of the Virgen, the churches were forced to open their doors to the penitents, and it was a way to sort of show workers their own power and the importance of religion. So his faith and the use of religious imagery in the movement throughout was a powerful way to help overcome the fear that workers had of joining this union when they were, you know, putting their livelihoods on the line to do so. The purges were, there were a number of purges. Purges were an important and unspoken for a long time part of the history of the UFW. The first purge really took place in 1967, and that's been talked about even less than some of the later ones. And I don't think that the issue really was the communist ties of the people who were purged. That became sort of a cover story. It was acceptable because there had been so much concern in the labor movement about communism, and you're coming out of the 50s and the McCarthy era and wanting to avoid the taint of that. But
and Miriam, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue this right after the break. We're talking with Miriam Powell about her new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. We'll talk about criticisms and people being denounced as traitors right after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call no matter where you are, 866-798-8255. Or you can post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. And following that at noon today, Backstory.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how students are paying for college. According to the College Board, over the past three decades, average tuition at a four-year public college has risen by more than 250%, while family income has gone up only 16%. So given these realities, how are families and students paying for college, and what role should the federal government play to make college affordable? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Miriam Powell about her new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. She's also author of The Union of Their Dreams, widely acclaimed as the most nuanced history of Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers. Miriam is a Pulitzer Prize-winning editor who spent 25 years at Newsday and the LA Times. And in her new book, she chronicles Cesar Chavez's life and activism and takes a frank look at who he was and the movement. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you've seen the new film about Cesar Chavez, we'd love to hear from you. What did you think of it? What questions do you have about the exhaustive research that Miriam did looking at Cesar Chavez? She also took a look at the archives of the UFW, included listening to tapes of board meetings. If you're active in this movement, what do you think we can learn by taking a very honest look at Cesar Chavez and the union? Again, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. So, Miriam, what else would you like to say about Max's question about purging communism? And then what can you tell us about, you know, volunteers who were bombarded with criticism and often denounced as traitors and infiltrators? I mean, why were they called traitors and infiltrators?
Well, to back up, you know, in the earlier years, the idea, there was a concern about avoiding the taint of communism and being on the extreme left. But there is a lot of evidence in the archives and in notes that were taken of the meetings at the time, even at the earliest purge in 1967, that the real concern was that there was a conspiracy to take over or influence the union in directions that Chavez did not want it to go. So the people who are purged are too independent-minded for some reason, and they include figures like Luis Valdez, who is probably familiar to your listeners, who was the father of Chicano theater and had founded the Teatro Campesino on the picket lines. And they were forced out, and that was the first purge. That was never talked about. In the later years, the purges continued in the 70s, and there were volunteers who were thrown out, sometimes later on in very public ways and humiliated. And part of the reason to denounce people as traitors is that if you denounce someone as a traitor, it takes away their standing to raise a legitimate issue. So it was a very effective way of both drumming out people whose loyalty was suspect for some reason or who were creating problems, and then also sort of undercutting their ability, should they want to publicly raise any challenges. And I think it's important to remember that in this period of time particularly, and in the sort of the, you're coming out of the Vietnam War movement, the student protest movement, the civil rights movement, and so on, very much the ethos of the left was that you don't air your dirty linen in public. And so people who were purged did not talk about it for decades because they were afraid that if they did, it would jeopardize a cause that they, you know, still really believed in. And they believed the union was the best hope for advancing the cause of farm workers.
What did you learn about his opinion of leftists and what they stood for?
think he didn't trust them, but he didn't trust people in general. I mean, he was not closely affiliated with the leaders of the Chicano movement or other movements at the time. He very much ran his own show and wanted to keep control, and leftists tended to be pretty outspoken people and had sort of political views that were not, not consonant with his direction for the union.
Well, we have a caller who couldn't stand the line, wanted to know what he thought of the Chicano student movement.
Uh-huh. It's somewhat ironic because later on he becomes clearly the symbol of the Chicano movement and the leading figure that we think of today. But at the time, in the early years, he did not have a close affiliation with the Chicano movement in its infancy, and partly because some of the leaders of the Chicano movement were less committed or not committed at all to nonviolence, which was something that he espoused, and also again because it sort of took diluted the strength of his ability to sort of control the vision. So I think he used the Chicano student movement particularly to generate support on campuses later on in his life, but did not really have a close affiliation.
I'm speaking with Miriam Powell about her new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. And let's go next to Alan in Aptos. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to know what your interviewer has to say about Frank Bardicke's book, Trampling Out the Vintage, which was published by Verso Press in 2011, which covers much of the territory, including some of the less laudatory aspects of Cesar Chavez's life, in about 800 pages. So she's got her by about
That's right.
300 pages. I knew they had some contact before publication of both of their books. I'd like to know what she has to say about that.
Well, thank you. We actually had Frank on when he came out with that book, and Miriam Henry also wrote in and wanted to know what you thought about Frank's book, specifically the what Henry calls a devastating picture of the way Chavez ran the union.
You know, Frank's book Frank is very ideological. He was a leader of the student move, the student movement at Berkeley. He is much more politically engaged than I am. I'm a journalist and a scholar. And I think Frank wrote the book that only Frank could write. It is a very ideological book. And he tells the story really from the perspective and the focus on workers, on vegetable workers. And those are his heroes. And he shapes the book around them. It takes place only in a fairly limited time period. It covers some of the same ground that I also covered in The Union of Their Dreams from a more sort of diffuse perspective of characters. And I think that it's a worthy contribution to the literature, and there are points on which we agree and points on which we disagree. But it shapes the story from a very particular perspective, and that is that of the workers, and that's an important contribution.
Well, and as you've pointed out in so many interviews, the key question today is, are farm workers any better off than mm-hmm. they were back then? And so what are your thoughts on how Chavez ran the union and how that still affects farm workers today?
Well, as I said at the beginning, I got into this from the present and from a series that I did for the Los Angeles Times that basically said that the UFW had withdrawn from the fields quite some time ago. So it is not a force, and a lot of that can be traced to certain actions that he took. I think there, again, are kind of reasons for what he did, and I explore them in depth in the book in a way that really has not been done before. So I think that you should, again, you can agree or disagree with what he did, but you should understand what drove him and why he did it. And that's the point of a biography as opposed to a history of the movement, which is something different and which is more what Frank attempted to do from his perspective. So conditions are not very good in the fields. In many cases, workers are making less in adjusted dollars than they were in the early 1980s at the height of some of the vegetable contracts. The community CRLA, the California Rural Legal Assistance, which is the greatest sort of force in the fields these days, recently came out with a report about housing conditions that was just deplorable. I think there are, you know, obviously a lot of problems, and you have, as we talked about, a largely undocumented workforce. The labor contractors are back in full force. Those are the middlemen who do the hiring, and that was one of the goals of Chavez and the UFW in its early years, was to abolish the labor contractors. So that is back to where it was before. On the other hand, there are obviously more health and safety and labor laws on the books now than there were, you know, at any time when he was starting out, when farm workers were not covered by virtually any laws. There was not employment and insurance. They were not covered by health and safety and labor laws. The California remains to this day the only state that has a law that protects union activity in the fields, the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act, which was negotiated and passed in 1975 by a young Governor Jerry Brown. And it remains on the books as probably the strongest pro-labor law in the country. It is not being used these days very much, but it is there. Yeah. So there are pieces of the legacy that remain, but conditions in the fields are not particularly good.
Yeah, not at all. You've got a number of photos in your book of Cesar Chavez, and one of them is when in August 4th, 1988, during his last and longest fast, he was visited by Ethel and Robert Kennedy's children. You have a number of photos of him with high-profile politicians. How was he affected by power and the access he eventually got?
Well, I think he used the power to his advantage. He didn't cultivate people because he liked being around them particularly, but he recognized how important it was to bring power from outside to bear. I think he understood from the time that the grape strike started in 1965 and even from before then that the strike was not going to be won in the fields for the reasons that we've discussed, for the power of agribusiness within the agricultural valleys. And so his brilliance was in forming these kinds of strategic alliances and taking the strike outside through the boycott and through alliances with important labor leaders, religious leaders, and political leaders. And certainly the Kennedy family, which was beloved by the Mexican-American community for multiple reasons, you know, and Bobby Kennedy was an important figure in breaking the fast with Chavez and in speaking out at hearings and so on. So his ties to the Kennedys were strong and were important for organizing.
I'm speaking with Miriam Powell about her new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. And Miriam will be speaking this Saturday, April 26th at 4:30 at the San Francisco Public Library, talking about her 9 years of extensive research looking at Cesar Chavez's life and the United Farm Workers. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Rachel in San Francisco. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love this topic, and I was curious if you know anything about Cesar Chavez's relationship with Carlos Bulosan, who is an organizer for Filipino farm workers.
I don't know about his relationship with him specifically, but certainly the Filipino workers were an important and often overlooked piece of this entire struggle. As you probably know, it was the Filipino workers who initiated the strike in 1965, and it was Larry Itliong who was the leader of them. There is a new film that just is coming out now about Larry Itliong's life called The Delano Menangs, which I think will be a real contribution to documenting the history of the Filipino farm workers. The Filipino leaders, the two unions, there was a Filipino led union that merged with the farm workers union that Chavez led in 1966. And I think ultimately the Filipinos often felt like they were second class citizens in a Mexican led union, and there were efforts to bridge that. But Larry Itliong quit in 1971, was very bitter, was angry, talked about why he was quitting and why he felt that he was shut out of the leadership. And then in 1977, Chavez went to the Philippines as a guest of Ferdinand Marcos. And that became also a very controversial flashpoint for the Filipino community and for a lot of non-Filipinos who were already very appalled by the Marcos regime and by the martial law and its consequences.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Rachel. Let's go next to Larry in Berkeley. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. This is Larry Bensky. You know me.
Oh, hi, Larry.
Hi. One of the little-known aspects of my life is that I was Cesar Chavez, at least nominally, for about 5 years in the early 1980s. I was a direct mail copywriter, and I wrote all the United Farm Workers' appeals for money, signed by Cesar Chavez. And in that connection, I had to meet with him numerous times. I spent quite a few nights in the guest trailer down at La Paz. I spent a lot of time in his office with him. I met him also in other places, including up here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I think your guest is correct in many ways. He was someone who was really a very private person and did not like to trust others and share authority and structure with others. And this was, I think, what led to the downfall of the union. It wasn't all this stuff about external leftists or purges or the Synanon group games that they played. All of those were real. But the fact of the matter was he was trying to do something enormous, and he was trying to do it only trusting himself, not building an adequate staff support system around him. Now, one of the things that I haven't read your latest book, but I read your earlier one, and I certainly have read Frank Bartike's excellent book, Trampling Out the Vintage. One of the things that people don't generally realize is that Chavez was being torn in so many directions at once. The direct mail operation that I was a part of, for example, they built a printing plant and mailing shop right in their property at La Paz, so they didn't have to contract out for services and could save money that way. And it was a state-of-the-art facility. They had a radio station that broadcast to farm workers from there. Cesar Chavez, I can tell you, was invited 5 times a day to go speak somewhere about something in the years that I was with him. And he had just one person who worked with him, basically, fielding the telephone calls and the correspondence. It was an impossible life that he was eventually called upon to lead in the years that I was with him. And because of the things that you mentioned that I'm reinforcing here, it did result in the ultimate collapse of the farm workers' movement. But it didn't collapse by itself. It was part of a general onslaught against unions in the United States, which has now brought all of our unions, and I'm a member of two, to a very parlous state. So it's complicated. It's difficult. His accomplishments should not be minimized. And the greatness of the man just radiated out, but so did his flaws.
Well, thanks for that. I mean, I couldn't agree more with most of what you said, and that's why it took 500 pages to write about him. So I do discuss, actually, the printing facility that you mentioned and the sort of transition in the 1980s and the importance of the direct mail and also his speaking. And ultimately, he becomes, in his last years, this enormously popular speaker on college campuses around the country. And also just the fundraising and the fact that the union always did rely on outside sources of money and never was supported by its members. But there's a clearly, as you point out, a direct connection between his tendencies and his need to control and his difficulty in delegating power and what happens later on. And the tapes become this just a wonderful resource for understanding and exploring that, because you can hear this sort of agonized discussions and debates and the philosophical questions about, are we a union? Are we a movement? How can we do both? And he really, really struggles with that. And again, it sort of goes back to my point of, I think it's important to understand what he was thinking and doing and not just be judgmental from the outside of those, you know, of his choices.
Well, what did you come up with in listening to these? Because you write at one point in a board meeting, he threatened, quote, "I got to be the king or I'll leave." And then you also write, and this is a really fascinating part of the book, when he talked about whether or not this is a union or a movement. We're at a stage where we have to make a decision because it's neither now. So what was it, a trust issue, or what did you come up with just based on what you heard?
you know, it's complicated to, so I'll try to summarize it quickly,
yeah.
But basically it goes to what your listener said and what we've been talking about, which was the need to control this and his belief. And a lot of this goes back to his experience in the community service organization, where he empowered people who became, as they moved into the middle class, adopted middle class values and stopped wanting to or caring about the poor, and his determination not to be in that position again. So he believes in the power of sacrifice. He believes that what he wants to do is organize poor people, and he can't quite make it all work. So he says from the beginning in 1965, he says we have to be a cross between a movement and a union. And as your listener pointed out, in the later years, there's a medical plan, there's a pension plan, there are health clinics, there are radio stations. It's this enormous operation that has to be run, and there are tens of thousands of members and hundreds of contracts, and they have to be administered, and you're trying to do that with a volunteer staff. And how do you make all of that work? He brings in management consultants. He preaches for a while. There's a point where he explains to people that you have to create a management structure, and you have to delegate responsibility and then hold people accountable, and that's how we can continue to grow. So he understands that. He's a smart guy. He just can't quite do it. He cannot delegate responsibility to the extent that it would have been necessary to make the thing really work.
You also write that with the exception of Dolores Huerta, women remained in the background and played traditional roles. Quote, they typed, answered the phone, took notes at the Friday night meetings. Chavez had absorbed his mother's lessons about gender roles, and the nascent women's liberation movement had not affected his ingrained views. Of course, I never change our kids. I never even learned how to put a diaper on, he boasted. He believed that women needed to be involved in the strike to make sure they supported their husbands. He wanted women transcribing notes and doing other secretarial work because they were made for this kind of tedious work, end quote. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Those were quotes that were from the late 1960s. So, I mean, I think in fairness, his rhetoric evolved a bit in the later decades of his life. But the movement was a tough place for women to be. And if you talk to women who were volunteers and who were involved, I think they had a sort of an extra burden, and it was not a tough thing to be a woman in the movement at that point in time. So, it was an ingrained attitude, and there was certainly a certain sense of machismo in the union as well.
Talk a little bit more, though. What about his actions? I mean, what did his actions reveal about what he thought about women and the role they should play in the movement?
Well, he talked a lot about the need to organize women because you needed the women to support their husbands in terms of, and again, this is going back to the strike years, that if women were not supportive of their husbands joining the struggle, whether it be on the picket line or as a picket captain or in the boycott, then that was going to be a problem. So you needed to organize the women in order to support their husbands and their families' involvement. He also unselectively made very good strategic use of women. So there is a famous scene early on in the strike where the sheriff in Kern County says that shouting the word huelga, which means strike in Spanish, was illegal, and he was going to arrest anyone who did that. And so Caesar went to Helen, his wife, and got a group of women and then a group of ministers and had them all go out and deliberately shout huelga and get arrested. And 44 people got arrested. And then the women went to jail, and there was a prayer service where their children were brought to outside the jail that night. And so that was, a very strategic use of women, including Helen Chavez, as to sort of help, again, drum up support and increase the power of the strike.
And she's definitely not a widely known figure, his wife, Helen. You report that she preferred to stay out of sight as much as possible and avoid the limelight?
She's a very private person. She did not give interviews even, throughout the life of the strike. And They have 8 children, and she stayed home and took care of the kids. But she also, when he asked her to run the credit union, which was set up in before the strike even happened, when it was still the Farm Workers Association in 1963 or 64, they set up a credit union, and he turned to her and asked her to run it, and she learned how to do that. So she's a very competent, strong figure. She became a role model for many of the women who were around in the early years as volunteers, but yes, a very private person.
We have time for one more quick call. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. A couple of things occurred to me as I was listening to this. I'm going to turn my radio down.
And we have about 30 seconds, Greg.
Well, anyway, just how difficult, it is to... Hello?
Yes, you're there. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. How difficult it is to achieve progressive change in this country, even if with the tremendous efforts that were made by him and just throughout the history of this labor movement, et cetera. The other thing I wanted to say quickly was this. The United States, I mean, people on the left don't seem to realize the power of boycotts and the kind of things that Chavez did. But I just want to relate this to what the United States is doing. Whenever the United States wants to put the pressure on people, unless they use military force, they resort to sanctions. And I don't know why the left does not realize how incredibly powerful boycotts can actually be.
So let me just say very quickly that I think you raise a point that goes to his lasting legacy, and that is that he trained a generation of organizers and activists who came out of the movement and are sadly not in the fields, but are working in other spheres for social justice. And many of the tactics that he pioneered, and by showing people how even the poorest people who had nothing to give to the struggle, but in many ways their own lives, could achieve social change through, you know, very strategic collective action. And that's his ultimate, you know, in many ways, his legacy and the lessons that we should continue to study.
And in just 30 seconds, Miriam, what do you think of the farm workers movement today as they're struggling for some of the same things they struggled for back then?
Well, I think the farm workers need a union, and they don't have one, and that the UFW in its current form is not a force in the field and is not going to be the union that helps them. So hopefully someday some other force will arise, and, you know, comparable to what the Immokalee workers are doing in Florida, where they've achieved a lot of real progress for farm workers.
Miriam Powell is author of the new biography, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. She's also author of The Union of Their Dreams. She's a Pulitzer-winning editor who's spent 25 years at Newsday and the LA Times, and she will be speaking Saturday, April 26th, this Saturday, 4:30 at the San Francisco Public Library. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your
Call. How are students paying for college? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the underlying reasons for the rising cost of higher education. According to the College Board, over the past 30 years, average tuition at a 4-year public college has risen by more than 250%, while family income has gone up only 16%. So how are families and students paying for college, and what role should the federal government play to make college affordable? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.